And we welcome now technology commentator Sarah Patt. Morena. Sarah, welcome.
Kia ora, Catherine. How are you?
I'm very, very well, thank you. Let's get into Congress and what hopes for any action to come out of these hearings, including significant ones from whistleblowers. The latest subject matter, I think, is TikTok, Snapchat and YouTube appearing.
Absolutely. So we know, obviously, that, you know, it's been going on for some time, that the big tech companies, their day of reckoning is coming. Now, for the for New Zealanders, you know, our government doesn't have a huge influence. So a lot of what happens in Congress in Washington really can have a big effect on what we see in these apps over here. And obviously TikTok, Snapchat and YouTube are huge amongst young people, children and teenagers. And there's been a lot of concern, and rightly so, around the effect that they are having on children's health and well-being. And as you mentioned, the whistleblower Frances Hogan, she is actually before the Securities and Exchange Commission talking about a whole bunch of documents that she's leaked around Facebook and whether or not they knew that social apps, in particular Instagram, caused harm to young women, teenagers, and what they did or didn't do to curb that harm. But so it's really the time for these other ones to come before Congress. And Richard Blumenthal, who's a senator for the Democrats, he's running this committee on consumer protection. And he hauled the three of them before a whole bunch of the senators just yesterday, and talked to them about, you know, what are they doing on their platforms to curb harm? You know, how do they prevent harmful content and predatory behavior, and things like, how robust is their age verification? You know, are they really, how are they monitoring and making sure that kids aren't seeing harmful content?
What have they said so far?
Well, basically, they've all kind of sought to distance themselves from each other. So Snapchat's this, it's a lot like Instagram in many ways, but really what it is that it's kind of the whole thing is that messages disappear in 60 seconds. And that really it's a coalition. And what they say is that actually it's more about a friendship network. So you only really connect with people that you know in real life, as opposed to these other apps where the whole idea is to acquire a whole bunch of followers, because the more followers you have, the more popular that you are, and eventually the more money that you make, because, you know, people are monetizing their TikTok connections and their Instagram and all of that, often through brand alliances and things like that. So they sort of talked about that. And YouTube is also talking about things that it's trying to bring in more, it's trying to moderate its kids section so that its channels that people that have channels that are very successful, but they might be either negative or overly commercial. I mean, there are apparently kids channels, you know, directed at kids where they unbox toys. It's something that we saw in tech, you know, you used to get the new iPhone, you'd unbox it, you'd film that, you'd put it up on YouTube or on your site, and people would go, oh, that's really interesting. Well, now they're doing it with kids' toys. So really pushing that consumerism message, and obviously using, you know, their algorithms or whatever to push to more and more of that content. Well, they're saying they're not going to do that so much anymore, that they're really going to sort of be harder on the moderation and move the algorithms towards more positive content for kids. So they had a lot to kind of talk about. They said that basically they felt that they were putting these measures in place. But I think the most sort of damning comment, if you like, came from Senator Blumenthal at the end, who basically said, you're basically telling me that you are not Facebook, and that is your defence. But, and I quote, being different from Facebook is not a defence. That bar is in the gutter. So I think that we might see some regulation very soon coming through to these companies, because if there's one thing that very divided government in Washington can agree on, it is that these social apps need some kind of, to be brought into some kind of control, particularly when it comes to kids.
They're so powerful, though, and this is always the challenge, isn't it? They have such power when it comes to what people see, what voters see. It's going to be interesting to see when they really get to the point of trying to actually do something, what pushback comes and how. And, you know, as for saying they're not Facebook, YouTube's algorithms are absolutely as to blame, if not worse in many ways, with the driving of people to extreme content. When it comes to the kids and the algorithm, what the algorithms are told to do, my understanding is that algorithms often aren't told to do evil. They are told to keep those eyeballs for as long as possible. In the case of the marketing you were talking about, are they programmed differently? Are they programmed in the way that attracts them towards purchasing certain products?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. The algorithms are designed to keep them on the sites for the longest possible time, and that's where the business model sits. And that is why we have had these extreme, sites and all the behaviours that have led to them. But what they are saying is that they are going to, in the case of YouTube, they're going to focus on more concerted moderation around the kids' content, and they are going to, when they call low quality content, they are going to try to move people away from that using the algorithm so that they're going to actively moderate it. And with the Snapchat, they say that when you put up a creative content, if it's going to be seen by more than 25 users, it will be moderated by a human. So they are trying to bring in these steps. But when they push and say, you know, it's transparency around these algorithms. How can you see where they are and how they're being directed? They're very careful. They don't really want to bring in the lawmakers. And I think that's where the sticky point will be in terms of trying to legislate this thing, is where's the transparency over the algorithms and how can that come about? So that is where I think the key will be. Things like age verification are kind of interesting as well, because how can you prove you're the age that you are when you go online? And for example, in Japan, in some jurisdictions, like for Japan, for example, you have to be able to provide proper ID before you get to a site like Tinder, for example. So, but how would you trust a company with your digital identification? So I think that's going to be a really interesting area as well, because there's lots of privacy concerns. I mean, I'm quite happy to upload my ID to a government site because I need to, if I want something like a passport or whatever. I know that I have to do that and I trust that. But would I trust an independent company with that kind of ID? So those are also sort of interesting kind of issues that are coming up as well, and that all need to be resolved. I mean, digital identification is going to be a huge growth area.
It is. We were talking just last week about some private companies wanting to do the sorts of verification that RealMe does here in New Zealand. And what I did find interesting about that was they talked about they don't have to see or hold your information. They are the intermediary who goes to a given department and says, can you confirm this? Can you verify this? And then the verification is done. Again, there's just a queasiness at the thought of private companies holding the most... they already hold intimate information about us, but when it comes to your actual identifiers, we know how dangerous that can be. And the question is really whether the security can be built around it. But as you say, it's just going to be, even with the COVID stuff that's happening right now, it's just going to be a massive growth area. All right, staying with the pandemic briefly, gaming, one imagines it's been rather popular during the sort of lockdown areas and right throughout the pandemic.
Oh, absolutely. And what I think was kind of interesting is that gaming was once derided as a social ill. You know, it was considered to be, you know, did it sort of move to, aggressive behaviour outside of the gaming? You know, if you played war games, etc. online, did that translate into real world behaviour? No, apparently, according to a whole bunch of academics. But I just think it's really interesting to see how gaming has changed. And a new survey out this week from the Interactive Games and Entertainment Association. So you know you would expect them to be promoting things through surveys, but it's robust. They looked at 800 households in New Zealand, and is a 3.5%. margin of error with Nielsen. So, you know, it's credible, and there's academic research behind it. And so basically what it's saying is that 3.7 million New Zealanders play video games, and that the average age of a video gamer is 35 years old, and almost half are female. So shattering some stereotypes there. And that 45% of New Zealand households have a GAIN subscription, and that during the pandemic, to your point, 76% of New Zealand parents turned to video games to connect with their children during the pandemic. So it was an activity that they could do with their kids, and you know, it was sort of promoted a sense of community and activity and shared activity. So I thought that was really interesting results that shows that gaming has sort of changed and evolved to become a very much a shared and community activity. And of course, you don't just need to on a game with people in your house. You can game, you know, across the country and, you know, right across the world.
So the average age is interesting as well, isn't it?
35 years old, exactly. Yeah, and I think it's also because that's the generation that grew up with gaming. So I think it's a habit that you possibly have for your life. You know, if you start gaming in your teenage years or your early teenage years, you know, it's part of what you do with your friends, you know, and so you probably evolve that, you know, and also I guess as well, 35 years old is, you know, that's people are parents, and if this survey is correct and 3/4 of them are using gaming to connect with their kids, then that makes sense.
Now, the startup scene is looking healthy at the moment.
Absolutely. So, yeah, so PwC and Angel Association, so early stage investing, released a report this week which said that it's been an absolute, you know, great 6 months for early startup companies, mostly in the tech area. So a lot of software companies, but also deep tech. So deep tech's that really heavy engineering and science, you know, long gestation towards commercialization. So lots and lots of investment. They had 66 recorded deals in the first half of 2021, and that's a 60% increase on the first half of 2020. So the pandemic has done nothing to slow down. If anything, it's accelerated investment in these new startup and tech companies. So fantastic to see, actually, this really burgeoning scene in New Zealand.
And many of them are, as we discussed, in the gaming area, although I know there's worry that we're going to lose some of those to Australia, which is being very aggressive in its courting at the moment.
Yes, absolutely. And that's obviously a big issue, talent, you know, trying to retain not just the businesses, but the people who, you know, who have the talent and the skills to create them and to work for them. Yeah, so absolutely, gaming and virtual reality. So, you know, companies like Grinding Gears, Kiwi Ninja, Rocket Works, these businesses are all, you know, doing lots of, you know, really, you know, putting it on the world stage, which is fantastic. And so good to see as well that New Zealanders aren't just consuming tech, you know, we're exporting it as well, which is what we absolutely need to do. You know, and like I said, you know, it's not just in gaming and virtual. I mean, I think is not a week goes by when I don't get like 2 or 3 press releases talking about, you know, new investment in businesses and, you know, or even sales, you know, exits. We've seen some big exits this year. You know, a couple this week, for example, I got one from Virtus Energy, which had raised $1.2 million to boost its biofuel, to biofuel production. It's turning green fuel from waste, creating green fuel from waste, sorry. And of course, the big story in the business pages today is Sharesies, which is the online trading platform. And they've just managed to secure $50 million expansion. Apparently, 9% of New Zealanders are using this investment platform, and they're talking about IPOing, so launching onto the stock exchange. I hope if they do, they go to the NZX, the New Zealand Stock Exchange, because that could certainly do with some new listings. Unfortunately, a lot of these businesses are going, you know, hopping across the Tasman and going to Australia. And we really would love to see more investment here, I think.
It is great also, though, to see some of these smaller players as well. The guys we had on this morning, we had one of them on anyway, Daniel O'Donoghue of Conquer, and just taking something as practical as trying to eliminate the paperwork from building sites that doesn't get done, it gets delayed, and building a system. When you build, it's the old age-old story of entrepreneurship, isn't it? Solve someone's problem. And when you solve the problem for something as large as the construction industry, if they can build this, and it's obviously exportable as well, it's become much more part of, you know, it's not just for the geeks and the programmers and the sort of the experts in tech, it has become much more mainstream and fundamental as a way to start and grow a business. And that is ultimately what you're really driving for, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, it does beg the question, you know, what is a tech company? Because, you know, it's they use the tech to create the solution. But is it really about tech, or is it just about, like you say, it's every sort of part of life? My understanding is one of the best software companies is people who spot everything being done on a spreadsheet and work out that software could do it better. That's where a good model business model lies. So if everybody's doing something on a spreadsheet in a sector, there's an opportunity. That's what I was once told.
Yeah. Software as a service, we know, are really, really an outstanding, burgeoning industry here as well. And that's where they're often growing to a certain size and heading off overseas. And again, we have to kind of let go of the sense that that's necessarily all bad. You've made the point many, many times. If reinvestment happens here, if they start a new business here, that's all good. A lot's happened. I know we're farewelling you today, Sarah, after many, goodness, how many years? A good number.
I think we're getting up to a decade, Catherine.
Wow.
So I did want to say thank you so much for having me on the program. It's just been fantastic. I've really loved it. And I really appreciate the opportunity to chat to you every so often about tech. It's been amazing. So
well,
thank you.
I was just reflecting how much has changed even in that decade. It's just phenomenal, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the rise of the tech entrepreneur and, you know, to our point right now, that it's not just about tech, it's not just about coding, it's about everything that you can think about. The rise of that innovation is just the story of the last 10 years or so, and enabled by things like the telco sector, which has completely and utterly transformed in the last decade as well, and is, you know, has enabled us to have this what I would consider a world-class fiber network, which is just helping us to export our IP to the world.
They may well be going absolutely hand in hand. Sarah, thank you for all the hard work. All the very, very best.
Thank you.
Sarah Putt, tech commentator.